From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, reflections on the struggles that challenge us and bring us together as we continue our month-long dive into 20 years of Latino USA archives, memories of September 11th, 2001 in New York City.
I think the most important thing for all of us is to be together, you know? Otherwise, nobody gonna help us.
Undocumented workers after 9/11. And then we remember life in New Orleans in 2006, 1 year after Hurricane Katrina.
But we're cooking in a small grill, electrical grill right now, because we got everything ready, but we don't have no gas.
And the Pan-American pastime in 1998, baseball, of course.
The Cubans have been playing since 1864. It's really part of the culture.
All this and more coming up on this special archive edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this month, we're taking a trip back through 20 years of Latino USA. For undocumented immigrants, if there's fear now, fear of going to the hospital, fear of being pulled over and deported, imagine that same fear amplified by the events of September 11th. In this report from our archives, we take you back to that time, the year 2001, just weeks after September 11th. We hear about the struggles of undocumented people living uncertain lives in uncertain times 12 years ago. Here's our reporter, Michelle Garcia.
In an old wooden building in the Manhattan neighborhood of Chelsea, more than a dozen men and women are trying to put their lives back together. All are undocumented, all lost their jobs on September 11th. Some 100,000 New Yorkers lost their jobs after the attack. An untold number were undocumented. They typically used fake IDs and assumed names. For this group, it takes a giant leap of faith to come out of the shadows and use their real names on paperwork that might get them some help. Omar Saracho, a volunteer for Asociación Tepeyac, walks them through the process. This Jesuit organization works almost entirely with undocumented immigrants. That's why 26-year-old Benjamin Gonzalez hopes they will understand his situation.
We don't have social security. We cannot go to the hospital. Now, if you see I have a problem with my eyes, but how am I going to pay if I have no money? But I think the most important thing for all of us is to be together, you know? Otherwise, nobody gonna help us.
Okay, entonces ya tenemos los datos personales, ¿no? Entonces lo que sigue sería obtener un poco de datos sobre los negocios.
So far, 250 displaced workers have attended these meetings. It's one of the few places the undocumented can receive specialized attention. About half the group receive their wages in cash, meaning they have no proof of employment, unless they can get their boss to agree to write a letter proving they worked in and around what became Ground Zero. A man we're going to call Jaime says that's not always easy.
The Mexicans come here to work, and we come with whatever legal papers we can get. I went to my boss, and he asked me, what do you need? And I said, we needed proof that we worked there. And he said all the proof he had was in the building, so everything was lost. And he tells me that they can get in trouble because of all the undocumented that work there.
Undocumented immigrants are not eligible for federal assistance and unemployment compensation. Private charities and some government agencies will help families of the victims and displaced workers regardless of immigration status. But it's a tricky process. Each organization has their own set of eligibility requirements. Most are located at the Family Assistance Center at Pier 94.
We will have an information form, and it does ask if they're a U.S. citizen or a citizen of wherever. The reason we ask that is because we are offering to help with travel and lodging. So if they do have family that's from another country, then we need to know that so that we know what to take care of to get them in, visas, what have you.
Bashir adds that they have seen very few undocumented families seeking help. At the same time, there is no apparent coordination with grassroots organizations like Tepeyac. The community group is still trying to help 65 families get to the United States. Families like that of Leopardo Lopez. He worked at the famous Windows on the World atop the World Trade Center. The 41-year-old cook is presumed dead. His wife and children are still in Mexico. Lopez's uncle, Gerardo Pascual, still carries around flyers that feature Leopardo and a phone number. Pascual knows immigration officials have promised not to track down undocumented families, but he still worries.
There's a little trepidation because we illegals, we don't know what the immigration is going to do afterwards.
For now, Pascual concentrates on wading through the bureaucracy of getting a death certificate, and if he's lucky, recovering Leopardo's body to send back home. When he's not on this mission, Gerardo Pascual says his mind turns to his former co-workers and his nephew at Windows on the World.
I dream about the co-workers. At the beginning, I couldn't sleep. I wouldn't eat. The first two or three days, I couldn't eat. I lost 10, 15 pounds.
Such grief is compounded with a sense of responsibility many of these searchers feel, says Counselor Genoveva Garcia, for their families here and abroad.
I'm supposed to be the strong person here, and I'm supposed to deal with everything. And if I got here, and if I've been through all this, whatever it was that they had to go through when they came here, and right now to say I'm feeling weak, I'm feeling bad, and I don't know what to do with this. They feel very bad about this, and it's very hard for them to ask for any kind of help.
Okay.
Back at the workshop, a woman that identifies herself only as Veronica tells her fellow paisanos that together they have power, that they keep New York City moving. With that, Omar Saracho concludes the session by urging them not to allow their immigration status to rob them of their own identity.
What kind of world is this where no one gets close and you don't know who you work with? Some people come and say, yeah, he worked with me. He was up there in the towers doing delivery, but they don't even know their names.
Quietly, the group resolves that in the spirit of rebuilding, they will try and heed his advice. For Latino USA, I'm Michelle Garcia in New York City.
And now on to another defining tragedy in our country, Katrina and the devastation of New Orleans in the year 2005. I found myself there not long after Katrina struck. My PBS TV crew and I wound up sleeping in a parking lot. And I remember as we looked out the windows of our car early the next morning that I saw day laborers forming a line outside. And I had a moment. I thought about how these workers help heal our country after disasters and what kinds of lives they have to live to do it. In our next report, we look back to the lives of New Orleans Latinos in the year 2006, just a year after Katrina hit. Here's reporter Rolando Arieta.
For the past 11 months, 40-year-old Mario Avila has been hard at work rebuilding houses along the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Avila is from Mexico City. Before heading off to work, he and co-worker Julio Ramirez gather at Lucio's Mundo Latino, a small shop tucked away in a weathered building.
Buenos días.
Ramirez and Avila enjoy meeting at Mundo Latino because they feel like they're back home.
And
since most of us don't speak English, we get together here with other fellow Mexicans.
La mayoría de los mexicanos.
Don Juan, hoy es día de depositar allí los depósitos de envíos, si no van a rebotar cheques.
That's Lucio Cano, the owner of Mundo Latino. He once lived in the coastal town of Pas Christian, Mississippi, and owned a Mexican restaurant there. Hurricane Katrina swept away both, so now he stays in a FEMA trailer. Soon after the storm, Cano spotted a new wave sweeping through the area, tons of Latino migrant workers.
So I came up with the deal to open this Latin store to serve my people.
There has never been a Latin American food store in Waveland or in the surrounding areas. Lucio's Mundo Latino is also a place to post jobs, buy phone cards, wire money back home, or to just hang out.
Well, they're looking for a small place they can feel comfortable, they can sit down, watch a Spanish TV show, talk to their friends, you know, just to socialize.
Avila and Ramirez go there for certain meals they can't find anywhere else, like
Menudo Mexicano
or Mexican tripe stew. They nostalgically savor a large bowl of menudo.
Pero está sabroso aún así. No es igual, pero está sabroso y nos hace recordar.
It doesn't taste the same, but it's still good. And it reminds me of our families and our homes as we await the day when we can go back and join them.
Y estar otra vez con todos por allá.
Lucio Cano occasionally cooks warm meals, like menudo, in a little makeshift kitchen in the back of the store with a two-burner electrical grill.
And we're going to start cooking in a little while. This is the sauce we're cooking right now. You can smell. We're going to be cooking some pork. But we're cooking in a small grill, electrical grill right now, because we got everything ready, but we don't have no gas.
We had four grocery stores in the city of Waveland prior to Katrina, and we have zero now.
Tommy Longo is the mayor of Waveland and visits the store regularly. He says with the rising migrant workforce in the area, opening a store like Lucio's was a very smart entrepreneurial move.
It's a beautiful little store. They offer a myriad of products that you normally wouldn't find here in Waveland. So, you know, they're filling a need in more ways than one.
Julio Ramirez gets his tortillas and beans at Lucio's. Mario Avila goes for his favorite soft drink, Jarrito.
Jarrito. Jarrito Mexicano. Aquí lo tenemos también para toda la gente. Refresco Jarrito de México. Hecho en México.
Lucio Cano says most of the goods he sells are hecho en México, but he also carries a few products made in Honduras and the Caribbean. And the most sought-out item?
People looking for a Coca-Cola. The Mexican Coca-Cola is a half a liter, and they love that. If you bring 50 cases in 1 week, I run out of it.
What's the difference between Mexican Coca-Cola and American?
First of all, it's in a glass bottle, a big glass bottle, and the flavor, it's a big difference.
And he says Mexican Coca-Cola simply tastes better. For Latino USA, I'm Rolando Arrieta.
Coming up on Latino USA, two men plan a journey home to Cuba in an unusual vehicle.
When change comes to Cuba, I think that entering the port of Havana, returning to our own homeland again with this truck, would be something wonderful, something honorable to tell our grandchildren.
Cubans planning to go back to Cuba in the year 2007. That's coming up. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In the year 2007, Fidel Castro was widely expected to pass away, something that still hasn't happened. But back then, like today, many Cubans were making plans to repatriate, including one creative pair of men we profiled 6 years ago.
For the past year, Luis Gras and Marcial Basanta have gone to work in matching navy blue mechanics uniforms. The lifelong buddies squeeze into a cramped garage at a Miami Chevrolet dealership. There, they've welded, buffed, and painted away to build the Libertad from scratch. On a recent morning, they were busy sealing the boat's windows and doors.
This makes it so that the doors are secure, that no water will get in there.
And she's an amazing sight, 24 and a half feet long with a wide bow, bright green as freshly cut grass, and created from a 1951 Chevy pickup truck. Hidden underneath the wooden-walled truck bed and between the rear wheels is a motor to propel through water.
Oh!
Building the Libertad is a bit of deja vu for Gras and Basanta. In 2003, the two tried to leave Cuba in an almost identical truck boat that they'd built in secret. But they didn't make it all the way to Florida on their first try. The U.S. Coast Guard caught them, sank their boat in the middle of the ocean, and sent the men home. Returning to Cuba just fueled Basanta's desire to leave, he says.
Since I was born, what I've seen is that things have constantly gotten worse. So imagine, how long are we going to stay this way?
Both eventually got U.S. political refugee visas, and within 18 months of their first trip, made it to Miami with their families. Now the two are paid to work full-time at the dealership, rebuilding the Libertad out of a donated, broken-down truck.
It has a hydraulic system. That's a Hercules motor that lowers it into the water. Here's the steering. When you turn the truck's steering wheel, see?
The boat's inaugural voyage will be low-key, just in the waters near Miami. But Gras and Basanta have bigger plans.
When change comes to Cuba, I think that entering the port of Havana, returning to our own homeland again with this truck, would be something wonderful, something honorable to tell our grandchildren.
With Cuba's path forward after Fidel still an unknown, Gras Basanta and Cuban Americans across South Florida are left with dreams of bridging a decades-long divide. Dreams of a short boat trip home and of their fellow Cubans waiting for them there. For Latino USA, this is Lija Navarro in Miami.
Rodriguez, Gutierrez, Ortiz. You might know these names from your local baseball team, but Latin American and Latino baseball players still face problems overcoming linguistic and cultural barriers. So here's a story from 1998 about Latinos and the Pan-American pastime, baseball.
This past May, a fight broke out during a Major League Baseball game featuring the Baltimore Orioles and the New York Yankees. Baltimore Orioles manager Ray Miller was the subject of criticism when he said that Latin players were more hot-headed and subject to losing their cool. Although Miller later apologized for those remarks, the event focuses on the changing face of baseball, with names like Hernandez, Rodriguez, and Gonzalez becoming a growing part of Major League rosters. It's easy to see that this great American pastime has taken on a more Latin flair. Joining us on Latino USA to discuss this trend and the potential changes is freelance writer Milton Jamail, who writes for Baseball America and USA Today's Baseball Weekly. Jamail joins us from the Latino USA studios in Austin, Texas. Now, Milton, the numbers provided by Major League Baseball provide quite a picture that there are just increasing numbers. Why this growth of Latin players, and what is the league doing differently than, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago?
The numbers are increasing now. 32% of all players in baseball are foreign-born, or mostly from Latin America. The Major League Baseball is not really doing much different. They should be doing more to help these players acculturate, to understand how to play in the U.S.
What are they not doing, and why are they not doing these things?
they've just never paid much attention to Latin America. They need to have more bilingual people on their staffs and their coaching staffs, people who did play baseball, who are now bilingual and know baseball really well. Some organizations are doing this. But as a whole, Major League Baseball has not done a very good job.
There is some criticism about the recruitment of these players from Latin America, some who come from very, very poor conditions. And I'm wondering, is exploitation of these players a widespread problem?
Well, I wouldn't use the word exploitation. I think you get players signed when they're 16. You have an obligation to train them to come here. A lot of these kids come from backgrounds of extreme poverty, never even thought about going to the U.S. And so I think training them in English is really essential. And then having an atmosphere where they feel comfortable.
Interestingly, despite the growing number of Latin players, there has not been a subsequent growth in Latino baseball announcers, reporters, managers. And obviously, this causes problems from time to time in terms of misunderstandings. Do you think this is going to change at all?
I hope so. I mean, the reason that I do what I do is that when I started, there was only one person covering baseball for an English language paper that spoke Spanish. Interviewers had trouble talking to them. I could speak Spanish. I could talk to them. The players were excited about talking to somebody that could understand where they came from and understand it in the language they preferred to speak. I think we need a lot more reporters who speak Spanish.
Well, by not having Latino reporters who are kind of aware of what's happening with this increasing number of Latin American players and Latino players, what kinds of stories are we missing out on? What are we not hearing about?
You're not hearing about how guys got into the game. You're just hearing the basic, what are you hitting, what are you doing, that kind of story. You don't get the stories that I do. I go back and talk to their families in Venezuela or in Cuba or in the Dominican, talk to their Little League coach, try to get an idea of what got them into baseball and why they really love the game. Because there is this feeling that this is an American game and only Americans play. The Cubans have been playing since 1864. This is a long time. So it's really part of the culture of Cuba, the Dominican, Venezuela, that people here, I think, don't understand.
Thanks very much for speaking with us on Latino USA. Milton Jamail teaches courses on Latin America and Mexico at the University of Texas at Austin. He's currently working on a book about Cuban baseball. And for this week, that's Latino USA. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or on Tumblr and do become our friends. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Diana Montaño, Brenda Salinas, Miguel Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com, and the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.